This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's slimy and it stinks, but you can learn a lot from garbage. Bill Rathje is an archaeologist who analyzes American values and lifestyles by studying what we throw away. Since 1973, he's headed the University of Arizona's Garbage Project. His team initially examined the contents of trash cans. Now they excavate landfills. You'd be surprised by some of their findings. For instance, Americans are trimming fat off their meat like never before, yet they're eating more processed meat like hot dogs and salami. More people throw away candy after Valentine's Day than after Halloween. And judging from the number of discarded birth control dispensers that still contain pills, not all women on the pill are fully protected. By studying landfills, Rathje has learned that much of what we believe about garbage is myth. For instance, many Americans have an exaggerated idea of how much landfill space is taken up by disposable diapers. They actually account for less than 2% of landfill contents. Bill Rathje is the co-author of the book Rubbish, The Archaeology of Garbage. He told me what does occupy most of the space in landfills.
Nearly 50% of the contents of landfills is plain old paper. Newspapers, packaging paper, non-packaging papers like computer paper, phone books, paper plates, paper cups, etc. Another major contributor to the volume of landfills is construction demolition debris, concrete, wallboard, rebar, lumber. That's something like 20 to 30% of the contents of landfills.
And what does it tell us?
Well, I think what it's saying to us is there are two things. In terms of the construction demolition debris, it's saying that we can be an awful lot more creative about how to recycle and reuse that material, because it's not loaded with hazardous waste. It can be reused. The concrete can be ground up into aggregate to use as the base for streets. Lumber can be mulched into cover for growing things, etc. I think in the case of paper, the most important thing that we've learned in our landfill excavations is the fact that paper just doesn't biodegrade the way we would like it to. I think we all believe that paper's okay to throw out because it'll somehow be turned back into humus and go back to Mother Nature. And what we found by digging up our landfills is that in 40 years or more, paper remains just about the same as when it was thrown away. Takes up the same amount of space, etc.
Can you still read it?
Oh, yes, quite readable. Oh, yes, it is quite readable. I can remember a couple of the headlines that I liked. My favorite is "Future of Europe depends on conference between Churchill and President."
Hmm.
So that was January 2nd, 1952.
Well, we're supposed to be recycling newspapers now anyways in many communities. How's the newspaper recycling working?
Well, I think the newspaper recycling is going very well in the first half of the loop. I mean, everybody's gotten the idea, I believe, that we need to recycle. And so what they do is they collect their newspapers and they put them out by the curb for collection programs. The problem is they're not recycling their newspapers. They're collecting them. You know, my mother, who's 80 years old, tells me she recycles her newspapers. And she doesn't. She collects them. She puts them out by the curb. But she doesn't have a $500 million paper recycling mill. And the problem that most people don't realize is that the mills that recycle paper have been full and operating at peak volume for the past 10 years or so. So all we're doing now is collecting more paper. What we have to do is we have to close the loop and complete the cycle. And that means we need to buy products made out of recycled paper. And that will create new markets, and that will create the building, the construction of new paper recycling mills. And that's what we need to focus on.
Boy, you know what I found really fascinating? That tires are the landfill nightmare because they rise to the surface. How do they do that?
Boy, now, Terry, if you figured that one out, you might get a Nobel Prize of garbage, because there are all sorts of theories, but no one knows the real answer of why tires float in landfills. And they not only just float up through garbage, but in landfills, when you cap a lift or a layer of garbage, you then put on a couple of feet of dirt as a barrier, and then you start a new lift. So the tires actually float through garbage, and then they can float through that cap, and then float through more garbage, and finally get to the surface. There are a lot of theories. Some of the theories are that because of changes in temperature, heat and cold and so forth, you get expansion of the tire and contraction, and when it contracts, the garbage around it fills in under the tire more rapidly than above it, so it pushes it up. The same kind of thing occurs with people who say that all the heavy equipment that drives over a landfill rumbles and shakes the garbage. So it's sort of like standing on a million pounds of Jell-O when one of those big trucks goes by. You can feel everything shaking and settling. And again, it's very likely that things settle under tires more than they settle above them. And I guess the real key element there is that airspace that's maintained. As long as that airspace is there, the tire will float. If you were to cut it in half so as to get rid of that airspace or trapped air, then they wouldn't float.
So you can't really dispose of tires in a landfill, huh?
It's not a good idea because they keep popping up on the surface. And what happens then is they're collected and usually put in a tire disposal area because nobody knows what to do with them in a lot of cases. And if they catch on fire, it's the worst kind of fire you can deal with. In Tucson, Arizona, a couple of years ago, the tires at Los Reales landfill caught on fire. The flames leaped 180 feet into the air, and there was black, sooty smoke from horizon to horizon. I kid you not. It was the only time that the Tucson airport has ever been closed down was because of that smoke from the tire fire. And it took a couple of days to put out. They finally had to bury it in dirt. So you don't want to mess with tires. Now, there are groups that have ground tires up and added them to asphalt on runways at airports to make the runway a little bit more pliant, you know. They have ground tires up and burned them as a component of incinerators. They've done all sorts of things with them. You can do those things, but they just don't seem to generate enough economic sense, enough money, that it's really a useful solution. So tires are still a very major problem.
Listen, I've got about four or five tires in my basement. What should I do with them?
Well, just hope they don't float up through your house. I don't know what you should do. I guess the best thing to do would be to call a tire dealer and see if any of them will take them back.
Yeah, what are they going to do with them? They're going to take them to the landfill,
maybe they'll retread them.
Well,
or they may take them to a landfill. Goodness knows.
Let me see. This was something I'm not clear about here. You're talking about how in landfills, things don't biodegrade quite like we thought. A lot of things really stay intact for decades and decades. Does that mean it doesn't really matter if we're throwing away things that aren't biodegradable, since a lot of the biodegradable stuff isn't going to really break down anyways?
Stuff that people say is biodegradable in a landfill is probably not. In other words, if you were to throw a newspaper on the side of the road, you know, God forbid, but if you were to do that, it would biodegrade. But if you were to throw the same newspaper in a landfill where it was buried under more garbage, it would maintain its visual form and touch and everything else for 40 or 50 years. Maybe more. My guess is probably 200 or more years. So I guess the message here is, you know, you hear about biodegradable plastics. The theory there was you take 94% plastic, add 6% cornstarch, with the idea that the microorganisms in a landfill will eat the cornstarch out of the plastic and break it into little pieces. But frankly, I'm very skeptical. And the reason is that we dig up all sorts of food debris and yard waste that is as biodegradable as the cornstarch, and it's in perfect condition. And we've dug up a lot of corn on the cob. And I have to be honest, if microorganisms aren't going to eat corn on the cob, I don't think they're going to eat cornstarch out of plastic.
So has this changed your attitude about using plastics or styrofoams?
Well, I think it has for me. You know, I think it was very interesting to look at styrofoam as an example. You take a styrofoam cup versus a paper cup.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that isn't really a paper cup. It's a plastic-coated paper cup. And so the styrofoam is actually recyclable, and very easily so, if you can get enough of it. And I think that that's the key element. The biggest problem with recycling styrofoam is there isn't enough out there to make it economically feasible to have a lot of plants around. So you just have a few plants, and you have to collect it from a huge area. If we were using more styrofoam, it'd be easier to recycle. It would not be getting into landfills. It would be conserving energy, etc. And the plastic-coated paper is very difficult to recycle, because in order to recycle it, you'd have to separate the paper from the plastic. And that's very difficult to do today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Rathje. He's an archaeologist who studies garbage, and he's the director of the Garbage Project at the University of Arizona. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. William Rathje is my guest, co-author of the new book, Rubbish, the Archaeology of Garbage. I'm really interested in hearing about how you've been studying garbage lately, you know, in the past few years since you've been working at landfills. I imagine you're out there yourself. You're just not sending out your students. You're
right,
in the landfills too, right?
I'm on site.
You're on site. So how do you protect yourself? Let's start with this. How do you protect yourself against getting sick from, inhaling and coming into physical contact with all the rotting stuff out there?
Well, I think that's a real good question. You know, when I brought up digging landfills to my co-director, Wilson Hughes, his initial response was, no, we can't do it. It's too dangerous. It's too difficult. You know, just forget it. And I just kept bringing it up for months and months and months, and finally Wilson got tired of listening to me and investigated the problem carefully and found that there's a machine called a bucket auger, and it's like an oil rig, an oil drilling machine, and at the bottom of the derrick is a bucket that's 3 feet in diameter, 4 feet high, hollow at the bottom like a cookie cutter, with graphite steel teeth around the bottom edge. It spins around, and it can dig out a core 107 feet deep. And the first thing we did was we, you know, got heavy boots, lab coats, gloves, face masks, and other kinds of protective gear. And I would have to say, however, that those face masks sure get hot. And I took mine off the first day of the first dig, and after about 10 or 15 minutes, the smell went away. So I didn't think too much of it. But the smell really doesn't go away. It sticks with you. So I took my crew to lunch at a Pizza Hut that day. And when we walked in, I was a little worried we weren't going to get served in time because it was quite full. But after 5 minutes, we were the only customers left. In fact, I think that's where they got their idea for delivering pizzas, because I remember the manager standing at the door saying, listen, next time for you guys, we'll deliver. But the point is that the people that drive the bucket augers are out there 5 to 6 days a week, 30 to 40 weeks a year on landfills, digging wells. They're right over the top of them, and not one of them has had any kind of serious medical problem. Now, we are in the same kind of situation, only for a much shorter period of time, and we're very careful to examine the records and the background of the landfills we're digging. We are not digging hazardous waste disposal sites. We do not dig sites that have received significant quantities of industrial waste or even heavy-duty commercial waste. We're very careful to protect our students.
What's the most disgusting thing that ever happened to you at a landfill?
Well, I can certainly tell you that without having to think twice. We were at Fresh Kills Landfill on Staten Island, world's largest landfill, about 2.3 billion cubic feet. And Fresh Kills is an interesting place because it was begun by New York City in 1948, and it was a big tidal swamp. You know, today it would be protected against any kind of damage. But in 1948, the theory of landfills was you dump the garbage into marshes or swamps, fill them up, and then build houses and churches and schools. And what we found in our dig was that the garbage that was placed directly in contact with the water and had that tidal movement of water and had naturally occurring methanogenic bugs did biodegrade into a gray slime. But we'd never seen that at any of our other landfills, which are lined and which don't add a lot of fluid and where there's no circulation of fluids, etc. So I was standing next to the bucket auger when it went down to the bottom and hit the bottom of the first well. And the bucket came up, and Buddy Kellett, who was driving the bucket auger, leans over to me where I was standing, right next to where he dumps the bucket, and he yelled at me something that I couldn't hear over the noise of the engine. Well, what I figured out later was he was saying, "Bill, if you have any brains, you'll move back, because this bucket is filled with stuff, and if the wind hits it, Bill, you're going to be in deep trouble." And then he said, "Gee, I'm sorry, Bill," because the wind did hit it, and I was slimed from head to toe, covered in this gray goo. And I must admit that while most of us think of biodegradation as sort of next to godliness, I must admit that after having been slimed by the end results of it, I don't think of it that way at all.
What did you do to clean yourself off? It's not like they have showers in the middle of landfills.
No, actually, there was a National Geographic photographer there, and he had me stand around for about 15 minutes while he took pictures of me and my slimeness. By that time, the only parts of my body that were exposed were was my face. That was the only part that got slimed, and only on one side. So by the time he had finished taking the pictures, it was dry. I sort of washed it off with some drinking water we had. We finished an hour later, and I went back to my hotel room and took a shower for about 3 days.
What keeps you going back to the landfills, considering, how smelly and unpleasant it is? You've been slimed once, but you keep going back.
Well, Terry, I'm an archaeologist, and I guess that, you know, when people think of archaeologists, they think of King Tut's tomb, and they think of all these beautiful things, but 99% of what archaeologists dig up and study is garbage. And the garbage that we have in these modern landfills is the best, most descriptive garbage of a lifestyle of any that's ever been created by humans. I mean, it really is an incredible gold mine for an archaeologist. All the information that's there about our diet and about our recycling, about our attitudes, about our behavior, it's really fantastic. And I also have to say that they're no more interesting and fun people in the world than garbage men.
What's one of the most surprising things you've learned about contemporary American culture by studying its garbage?
Oh, I suppose that to me one of the more surprising things was that we're very schizophrenic. That may be a little too serious a word to use, but, you know, when we started sorting garbage, I thought we were going to find bags of garbage that were clearly from junk food junkies and bags of garbage that were clearly from health food nuts. You know, you could separate it out. This family eats healthy, this family eats junk food, etc. And that's not the way it looks at all. I mean, we all know what we should eat, and we buy some of that. And we all know what we like to eat and the convenience that we need in our diet, and we buy some of that. So when you find in a bag of garbage Mrs. Nutter's 29-grain, good-for-you, high-fiber bread, you're bound to find a Hostess Twinkie.
But it's not necessarily the same person, you know? It might be one person in one house eating the grain cereal and the other person eating the Twinkie.
No, that's very true. But I have a sneaking suspicion that because of the pervasiveness of this, that, yes, it could be different people in the family, but I think there's a little bit more within individuals than we like to recognize about ourselves. We also have a thing we call the yuppie dilemma. You know, we go to the supermarket, we know what's good for us, so we buy the fresh produce and the fruits and vegetables and salads we're going to make and all this other stuff from scratch. But we also know what our life is like, so you take home the microwave dinners. And after 2 weeks, the packages and the microwave dinners are in your garbage and in your refrigerators, a head of lettuce that's blue and gooey. So what we find is, ironically, the more processed foods people buy, the more fresh food they waste. Because they're thinking that they'll use the fresh produce, and then they just don't.
That's interesting. Solve this problem for me really quickly before our time runs out. I spent my weekend cleaning out hundreds and hundreds of magazines that I really wanted to get off my hands. Now what do I do with them? I've got them all stacked up. They're ready to go, but go where?
Well, I'd say first thing you ought to do is look in the phone book under waste paper, and you'll find waste paper dealers. They might take magazines, but magazines are very specific, and they're clay-coated, so they're not the best for recycling. I would also call up, St. Vincent de Paul or some charity kind of organization and see if they need them, or a nursing home or something like that. You know, one man's trash is another man's treasure, and somewhere there is someone who wants those old magazines, wants to read them, wants to research them, wants to use them, wants to decorate his house with them, goodness knows what. But somewhere there's somebody who can use that. And if you find them, then you really deserve a gold star.
William Rathje, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
William Rathje heads the University of Arizona's Garbage Project. The new book, Rubbish, The Archaeology of Garbage, was written by Rathje and Cullen Murphy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.